Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is busy relearning the guitar parts to his favorite Fleetwood Mac songs. Today, I am joined by my usual co-hosts, Catherine Mengu-Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as a special guest, Reason senior editor and Supreme Court watcher extraordinaire, Damon Root. Everyone say hi.
Howdy.
Hey, Peter.
Hello.
Happy Monday. So today we are going to talk about abortion, guns, school choice. It's a really light, kind of going to be a very funny show. Before we get to that, however, everyone wants to make sure their family is protected in a medical emergency. But what you may not realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full amount of an emergency medical flight. Even with comprehensive coverage, you could get hit with high deductibles and copays. That's why an Air Medcare Network membership is so important. As a member, if an emergency arises, you won't see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Best of all, a membership covers your entire household for as little as $85 a year. AMCN providers transport more than 100,000 patients a year. No family should be without this coverage. As a listener of our show, you'll get up to a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card with a new membership. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use offer code REASON. Okay, so I'm hosting again, which means we are bringing back segment titles. So we're going to call this first segment.
So like America, this podcast is not a democracy?
Not for the next 56 minutes or so. So I was going to call it Welcome to Lake Robegon, but it sounds like since you're all opposed,
where
I should
all
probably
the abortions
it,
are below average or should, are below 15 weeks.
If that's where you want to live, Nick, so I should probably call it, however, given the reaction, Roe is all of you. So Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court case that in 1973 granted all Americans a constitutional right to abortion, is no more. On Friday, the Supreme Court released its long-awaited ruling in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which was sparked by a Mississippi law barring abortions after 15 weeks. But the majority opinion, written by Justice Samuel Alito, not only gave a big judicial thumbs up to Mississippi's 15-week abortion restriction, it completely overturned Roe, along with the 1992 ruling in Planned Parenthood versus Casey that largely affirmed Roe. The upshot is that abortion is no longer a constitutional right in America. Now, that does not mean that abortion is illegal everywhere. Instead, it means that states can restrict the procedure as they see fit. Indeed, more than a dozen states have trigger laws restricting abortion that were set to go into place should Roe be overturned, and even more states are likely to restrict abortion further in the weeks to come. I want to start this week's discussion just by framing it a little bit, noting that despite what you the makeup of this panel, libertarians do not hold monolithic views on abortion, and that even some of the Reason staff here, even on the Reason staff, there are views across the spectrum. I know that is true of our listeners as well. So as we work through the Supreme Court's decision this week, I do want everyone to try to keep in mind that there are a range of views here that libertarians hold, and I want to wrestle with some of the ways that this issue divides libertarians. But before we get into those bigger picture questions, I actually want to go to Damon Root. Give us a recap of the constitutional argument put forth in Alito's opinion. And then, since I know you have some disagreements with Alito, tell us where you think Alito's opinion falls short.
Well, the central holding is that abortion is a right that's not in the Constitution, not mentioned anywhere. So therefore, it's got to clear some hurdles that the Supreme Court has invented over the years for unenumerated, unwritten rights, that they're deeply rooted in American history and traditions and necessary to the concept of ordered liberty. And Alito finds that the right to abortion fails that test. It's laid out in a case called Washington against Glucksberg. And so because abortion is not a constitutional right in his view and in the majority's view, the federal courts have no business recognizing it and enforcing it against the states. And it's a matter that is then returned to the states for state lawmakers to decide. Essentially, that how to define what's murder absent a constitutional provision, that's a legislative function, and that's a function for the states to do. That's the kind of the core of the argument.
So that's the core of the argument, but you have some issues there. And in particular, I think you have some arguments with the idea that this isn't deeply rooted in the Constitution. So that's a special phrase, right? That's not just sort of like a, that's not just a sort of some words that we are first now first hearing in this opinion. That is a test that they the Supreme Court uses, right? So talk to me about what it means for an idea to be deeply rooted in American history and why Alito thinks this isn't, but I think you think there is an argument that it could be.
Well, it's like a lot of legal concepts. It's judges can put more or less weight into it as they want to. And one of the problems with the deeply rooted in history test, as I've always seen it from the Glucksberg case, is that it just depends on how broadly or narrowly you define the right. So if it's a, let's say it's a right to access, medical care, life-saving medical care, pain-relieving medical care, we could probably say, yeah, that's deeply rooted in American history. Is it a right to use medical marijuana to alleviate pain when you have a chronic and debilitating and life-threatening condition? The Supreme Court said no to that. The federal courts have said no to that. That's the medical marijuana case, Gonzalez against Raich. So it purports to be a sort of principled bright line rule. It's really not. The Glucksberg decision was cooked up by Rehnquist and Scalia a bunch of years ago, precisely for this moment. There were very long fuse on that case, and the bomb went off on Friday. That was an opinion. These are conservative justices that are really deeply hostile to the idea of unenumerated constitutional rights because they see that as an invitation for liberal judges to engage in judicial activism. And so Glucksberg was written. That was a right to assisted suicide case. Is there an unenumerated right to physician-assisted suicide? Court said no to that also. So I've always had a problem with the Glucksberg test because I think it really shortchanges the constitutional scheme of unenumerated individual rights, which is there when you look at the original meaning of the Ninth Amendment. It's there when you look at the debates and ratification history of the 14th Amendment.
Just briefly remind viewers, listeners who are not who don't have a constitution like imprinted in their brains what the Ninth Amendment is.
The Ninth Amendment says the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. It was added to the Constitution by James Madison. So you got to remember, when the Constitution is first drafted, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, they're not there. They're not part of it. And the debate about the Constitution, the Anti-Federalists said you need a Bill of Rights, you need to enumerate some rights, otherwise if they're unwritten, they're unprotected. And the Federalists said, well, wait a minute, if we list some, then the government's just going to assume that anyone that's not listed is open season on that, and people don't have that right. So Madison puts a Ninth Amendment in there to say that unenumerated rights and enumerated rights are entitled to the same respect. So that, as just a baseline, I have a big problem with the school of conservative legal thought that it doesn't take that seriously. And then the 14th Amendment, which comes along in 1868, says that no state shall deny the privileges or immunities of citizens, and no state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And the history and ratification of the 14th Amendment is that both the Bill of Rights, the enumerated rights, and unenumerated fundamental rights of citizens and persons are applied against the states. So all of the individual rights provisions in the Bill of Rights, right to free speech, right to keep and bear arms, right to be free from unreasonable search and seizures, those apply against the states as of 1868. And then unenumerated rights also. And, you know, my argument about abortion we can get into is that you can find a limited abortion right in the original meaning of the Ninth Amendment. And then the Ninth Amendment is imported against the states through the 14th Amendment. And so there is a constitutional foundation. Certainly, a right that if you can identify a right as within the orbit of James Madison's Ninth Amendment, I think it should fit any rational definition of deeply rooted in American history. But I'm a dissenter from the Supreme Court on that.
Yeah, could you, Damon, talk a little bit about the history of abortion in America, because that's also part of Alito's decision, right? Saying, hey, you know what, like nobody was getting abortions until, or it wasn't legal until Roe, or a couple of years before Roe. But that's actually wrong.
So, as a
matter of history.
At the time of the founding, abortion is legal up until what's called the quickening. This is when the woman can feel fetal movement. And that could be 25 weeks. There's not an exact sort of week figure on that. That's British common law. You can read William Blackstone's 1765 Commentaries of Laws of England, and he gives this definition of, you know, life in contemplation of the law, life begins at the quickening, when the woman is quick with child. And so penalties for abortion from English common law at the time of the founding kick in after the quickening, but not before. I have this argument I lay out, but it is a right retained by the people under the Ninth Amendment, the freedom to end an unwanted pregnancy before quickening. That every state at the time of the founding followed the common law. The founders certainly all read William Blackstone very carefully. You know, if you look at the Supreme Court gun cases, the conservatives, they're all citing William Blackstone to help with the original understanding of the Second Amendment. not using them here, but you know, they use them in these other cases. So that's sort of the history. It becomes, states start to criminalize abortion into the 19th century, and then it's criminalized in a bunch of states, you know, into the 20th century as well. But you know, my sort of argument for constitutional meaning and original understanding starts with the Ninth Amendment as a right that falls within that orbit. And then you look at the 14th Amendment and how that would play out against the states.
So the quickening is also the moment in the Highlander films when the immortals get their power and the title of the sequel. Catherine,
by the way,
I really want to ask you.
It would have been nice if
movies.
Highlander had been aborted as a franchise.
Well, it's really hard. They're immortal. The only way you can kill them is to behead them. It's very complicated.
You know, you kill gods by not believing in them anymore. It works every time.
Damon has just given us a brief and extremely helpful history of a big legal divide between conservatives and libertarians. But like I said, abortion is an issue that also just divides libertarians, not just the, you know, sort of conservatives and libertarians. And there are, I think, some libertarians who might look at this ruling and say, that, you know, even ardent pro-choicers like Ruth Bader Ginsburg have said that that Roe, the original legal opinion, was quite poorly reasoned. And they might also say, look, Alito's opinion here, it doesn't ban abortion. It just puts the legal question to legislatures, which for the first time means there's a sort of federalist approach here. You have often made the case for policy responses that devolve decision-making, especially sensitive, controversial decision-making, down to more local forms of government. So what do you say to libertarians who might feel like this is good riddance to a bad judicial argument that caused a huge amount of political Sturm und Drang, and which is predicated on the idea that state legislatures are better positioned to handle this sort of controversial issue versus unelected justices?
Yeah, so I'm inclined to agree with the criticism of Roe I'm no Damon Root, but it does strike me that Roe...
it would be pretty weird if you were.
It would be awesome, frankly. I'm inclined to say that that decision, both its timing and its nature, probably did cause a lot of, as you say, Sturm und Drang that maybe could have been avoided. But I also think there are two ways to tell the story of what just happened. One is, okay, the Supreme Court overstepped its bounds and made a single diktat from the federal level above, which then governed the whole country. And that is therefore both bad and unlibertarian. Or you can say, well, what the Supreme Court did was essentially place the right and the decision making about abortion with individuals. And so there you could say, well, that was a good libertarian outcome, even if legal reasoning was not strong. You know, things that put choices in individual hands, we generally favor and think are for the best. And in that reading, the Dobbs decision has wrested power from individuals and placed it in the hands of a bunch of state legislators and governors, and therefore is bad. That is roughly my thinking about it from the perspective of this question of kind of federalism and devolution of power. But to be honest, you know, I think that it's also just very historically contingent. So the fact that we did have this law of the land for 50 years means that regardless of the kind of genealogy of how we got here, undoing it now and creating what will be a raging, you know, maybe not a 50 state battle, because there are lots of states where this will stay, where the sort of accessibility of abortion will stay quite stable, but maybe like 22 states, 25 states. And of course, that will come and go over time. It will now be a constantly fought and refought battle. There will be a ton of downstream consequences, which I think we'll get to in this conversation. But essentially, we're going to end up with a situation where we have, as one of our top Twitter guys, Tim Barati, sums it up at the end of a very good thread: more violence, more polarization, more acrimony, less civility, less respect for the rule of law, less privacy, more infanticide, and the poorest among us will be hurt the most. I think that's a pretty good summary of where we're going to end up.
That is many things. I do want to... That does sound a little bit to me like a libertarian standing athwart history or modern history and yelling stop. But
what does
Catherine's position that doing this now in this way, right, is going to cause a lot of upheaval? I take the point. I'm not even sure I think it's wrong, but I do wonder if there's a sort of it almost strikes me as a sort of weird mix of, it's like a conservative argument applied to the last 50 years of history. But Nick, I actually want to ask you a sort of related question about something you've talked about on this podcast and that you wrote last week for Reason. You've argued in quite strong terms here and elsewhere that Roe and Casey represented a remarkably stable consensus on abortion. And I guess I am not sure I totally agree with that, just in part because so much of Republican politics for the last 40 years, you know, since the birth of the Federalist Society, really has been predicated on overturning Roe, right? So overturning Roe has been a top level goal of one of the two major political parties for basically my entire life. And in that sense, there's been a kind of underlying political instability, even if in terms of in legal terms, right, and in some polling terms, right, sort of opinions have stayed basically the same. But I also want to sort of point you to some polls here. When you look at polls, obviously abortion polling is quite complex and you can pull out a bunch of different, you know, sort of ideas based on it. But you see, I think the clearest reading to me is that you see relatively strong support for pretty much unrestricted abortion rights in the first trimester. Weaker support for abortion rights in the third trimester, and a sort of very muddled middle, to the point where at least one recent poll, I believe in The Economist, YouGov, basically seemed to come to the idea that like the most popular position was actually a ban starting around 15 weeks with some exceptions after that. And that's not the Roe-Casey consensus, although it's also close to a lot of where European countries are. And it might be, you know, it's notable that this is a less of a contentious issue in Europe. So one thing I've heard pro-lifers and Roe skeptics say is that overturning Roe allows the public to find a more stable consensus through the democratic and legislative process. Do you think that's wrong?
Yeah, I do. Because it's also important that, you know, right now, and I remember interviewing Rand Paul about this, because Ron Paul and Rand Paul, every year that they've been in Congress or the Senate, introduced a life begins at conception law, but they knew federally there's no way they're going to do that. And this is, you know, Republicans since the 80s, basically since the end of the 70s, have been, you know, we are the party of pro-life. When they have legislative power, including when they have, you know, as many votes as they need to pass whatever law they don't, they did dick about criminalizing this at the federal level, just as Democrats did not take the opportunity to instantiate, you know, to pass legislation, you know, making Roe the law of the land as opposed to a Supreme Court decision. Both parties use abortion as a wedge issue, as a way to raise money, as a way to kind of create tribalism, but they don't actually do it. I don't care about the politics of it. What I've pointed to consistently is that since Roe, about, according to Gallup, never more than 19% of the population in America is against banning all abortion. And that has remained remarkably stable. What also has remained stable is that people are comfortable with unlimited abortion rights in the first trimester. And then as you get closer to the pregnancy coming to term, you have a lot more mixed views. What that models, or what that goes along with, is the actual practice of abortion. 93% of abortions are done before 14 weeks, at or before 14 weeks. Only one is done after 20. Only 1% happens after 21 weeks, which is before quickening. You know, then we can also talk about the more modern concept, although it's still kind of vague, of viability and things like that. So, as a cultural practice, attitudes towards abortion have been remarkably stable. What I find objectionable is when, you know, I don't believe that a fetus at 10 weeks has legal personhood. I don't think it should have all the rights that it might have at 9 months or at 8 months and 3 weeks. So that matters. But what we're talking about in the states that are going to ban abortion, and some already have, they are going to get more and more extreme in a way that contravenes how people have been, you know, performing or conducting themselves with regard to abortion. So that is remarkably stable. It also, you know, when we're talking about this, people act as if there were no abortions before Roe. Depending on, you know, the sources that you look at, there was somewhere, you know, between 500,000 and 1 million illegal abortions before Roe. So abortion doesn't go away. I think from a specifically libertarian point of view, I agree completely with Damon's
articulation of, you know, rights that that an individual has, that the woman has in this context. And I don't think that should be up for a vote. But beyond that, when you look at it, you know, we wouldn't say, well, you know what, because the government allows drugs to be legal, that means everybody has to do drugs. It doesn't do that at all. And it's the same thing with abortion. Abortion, you know, views towards abortion have been stable. The abortion rate has been coming down. It's been below what it was, you know, in the late 70s, shortly after Roe was decided, for over a decade. If you look at abortion, if it's a policy issue and you want to reduce the harms of a policy, of a law, you know, leave abortion the way it is and use moral suasion to reduce abortion if you're against it. And if you're not, and I don't think it's a moral issue. I don't think it's not the equivalent of murder, which is what a lot of libertarians say, but then they don't actually believe that, because if they did, they would be pursuing different kinds of criminal penalties against women who seek abortion. So, you know, that I feel like the logic, or rather the argument that Roe versus Wade politicized abortion is just simply wrong. And in fact, repealing Roe versus Wade is politicizing this issue far more than the American people have been thinking about it for the past 50 years.
Damon, speaking of politicization, one of the fears about this ruling is that it's not going to end with abortion. Instead, some worry that it will lead to the Supreme Court rethinking pivotal precedents on other cases involving unenumerated rights like gay marriage, contraception. And they worry in part because Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a lone concurrence saying that the court should, in fact, revisit those cases based on the logic here. These are all rights based in something called substantive due process. So can you just explain for normies here who don't read Supreme Court opinions for fun on the weekend, what is substantive due process? Why does it matter? Why is it relevant here? And is this ruling going to lead to a rollback of gay rights?
So the 14th Amendment added to Constitution in 1868 says that the states can't do certain things. They can't violate the privileges or immunities of citizens, and they can't deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law. As I mentioned before, the 14th Amendment, it's one of its central purposes is to nationalize the Bill of Rights and also nationalize some other rights. Before that, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to the states. So now, under the 14th Amendment, you have rights, they cross state lines. But there is a question of which provision in the 14th Amendment does this. And this is the big legal debate that Thomas is very much involved in. And for, you know, historical reasons that I can certainly get into, the Supreme Court has used the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to apply the Bill of Rights and unenumerated rights against the states. The court first did this during the Progressive and New Deal eras, enforcing an unenumerated right to economic liberty, economic freedom, the right to free labor. This is the famous Lochner case you've probably heard about. And then in the mid-20th century, the court started to use the substantive due process to enforce these unenumerated rights that people think of as more liberal rights, the unenumerated right to contraception, to privacy, to abortion, and then and ultimately gay marriage just a few years ago. Thomas thinks all of those cases going back to Lochner are wrong, their judicial activism, that substantive due process, that the due process clause is a procedural guarantee only. It does not allow courts to get at the substance of a law. That's that word substantive. So he would get rid of all of these cases. Interestingly, the liberals, they agree with him on Lochner. You know, the original opponents of substantive due process and of unenumerated rights were the left. As I said, in the Progressive and New Deal era, the court was enforcing unenumerated rights that libertarians would certainly cheer for, and progressives and New Dealers hated. And ultimately, Lochner was overturned in 1937, and it was overturned, the Supreme Court said, because the Constitution does not say anything about the unenumerated right to liberty of contract. So just to kind of get to the point about the legal rationale in Roe being muddy, which I agree, Roe has got some very bad sort of constitutional reasoning. And one of the reasons it does is because liberal and progressive judges have been sort of straitjacketed by the fact that their legal tradition sees Lochner as this terrible thing, and you don't want to be Lochnerizing, you know, heaven forbid. But meanwhile, they do actually want to be Lochnerizing. They do want to enforce unenumerated rights, substantive rights under the 14th Amendment. And so they kind of tie themselves into knots. And you see that in Griswold, the right to privacy case that leads to Roe, the abortion case. So Thomas is against all of that, and he wants the court to scrap that whole jurisprudence. Not the first time he's said this.
It's also not the first time that he has kind of invited future cases, right? I mean, Thomas ends up not just kind of saying the quiet part out loud in these decisions, but also suggesting, hey, here's a place where a future challenge might be warranted. And sometimes that pays off, right? That there have been cases that have resulted, and Thomas is basically saying, look, if you put forward this challenge, then now we have language on the books that is going to that we are going to have to recognize and think about going forward. And he's not just sort of adding a little bit of like, well, here's something else I have. Here's some extra thoughts here. What he is doing is shaping the future of the law, right?
Yes. Thomas is going to go down as one of the most influential Supreme Court justices, certainly of this era. You know, a justice can be influential because they write a big opinion like Anthony Kennedy did with gay marriage. You're kind of at the right place at the right time. And then you can be influential because you actually shape the law over the course of many years. And you see Thomas, you know, he starts off mostly in dissent and concurrence. And at this point, you see his views really winning the day. And he has a very long, successful track record of doing this. He basically called for the Heller, the gun case. He basically called for Citizens United, the big free speech case about corporate speech. So you should never wave away Thomas when he's doing something like this, because a lot of people, he is so respected among conservatives, you know, and I like him a lot. I have a lot of disagreements with him for sure, but I respect him, and I always take him very seriously. So yeah, he's looking to future cases. He's inviting future challenges. Lawyers, litigators, judges, they pay attention to this stuff. He's adopting a different 14th Amendment tool than the majority did in the abortion case here. But as the dissent in this abortion case points out, I think correctly, the logic of Alito's opinion does, if it was faithfully and fully applied, would imperil those unenumerated rights precedents. There's, you know, the right to gay marriage is not deeply rooted in American history at the time of that decision a few years ago. And you know, one person who said that was Justice Alito in his dissent. He was very forceful that this case the gay marriage case was wrongly decided under the Glucksberg precedent. All this, the exact same legal tools he used against Roe v. Wade would, if faithfully applied. Now, Alito has all this language in the opinion from Friday where he says, oh, don't worry about those things. This is different. It doesn't apply. But you know, him sort of waving his hand and asserting that is not the same as a principled application of legal rules. So there's a political question. Would the court actually go in and go after those things? And, you know, maybe not. That's sort of an unknown, and that's a different question. But the legal rationale absolutely is against those precedents. So, you know, who knows what the court will do, but it is in fact the case that the legal rationale of both the Thomas concurrence and the majority opinion also goes against Casey, the right to privacy case, you know, things like that.
If I may, you know, it's also interesting because a lot of mostly conservative commentators are like, oh, well, you know, there's no political will. There's no will to overturn gay marriage or sodomy laws, which is the other thing that Clarence Thomas explicitly says. We've got to do this. And if you believe, you know, substantive due process or a critique of that is another way of embracing majoritarianism, where as long as the people who are our elected representatives, you know, gained office through free and fair elections, they can say this is a right and this is not. And that's, you know, kind of the beginning and end of things ultimately. But only about 70% of people in America, and it's a record high, believe that gay marriage is you know, should be legal. That's lower. 80% of people, according to Gallup, using the same polling service, you know, say that abortion should be legal in some or all cases. And if fewer people also think that gay sex is moral. So, you know, we're looking at a world now where people are saying, oh, there's no political will for this or anything. But we have two members of a conservative Supreme Court laying out the legal argument for revisiting those. And in fact, abortion, you know, at least some access to abortion is more popular than gay marriage or getting rid of sodomy laws.
Yeah. And I think that underpins some of the discussions, arguments we've seen about, you know, groomers in Florida as well. Catherine, I do want to move this briefly into the realm of politics. I think some of the worst or most grating responses to this have been some foot stampy right wing arguments that we've seen over the last couple of days from folks like J.D. Vance and Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. It basically amount to an argument that pro-choicers only want to keep abortion legal so they can subjugate women through capitalist oppression, by which they mean jobs, which I thought jobs were like a thing that we were in favor of in politics. Like, that's what the politicians are like. You should be. We want you to have jobs. But Vance tweeted something to the effect of the left wants abortion so women can be stuck working 90 hour weeks at the New York Times. You're a woman. You worked at the New York Times. How many hours a week was it? No, I mean, like, are pro-choicers just out to imprison women in high-paying cubicles? What do you, like, how do you feel about this weird, line of argument that has popped up recently?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic example of a thing we've talked about a lot on this podcast, which is the left-right horseshoe and the ways in which we are being crushed between it, because it's of course, you know, just a strange perversion of the lefty anti-capitalist argument to say what Vance and Hawley have been saying. We're also seeing a slate of proposals from Marco Rubio and others that would, in theory, support all of these newly unwillingly pregnant women that they are about to kind of bring into existence. And there's a bunch of things in there that are worth debating. But the one that really caught my eye was that Rubio is proposing there's already some federal money going to these through various channels, but more aggressively federally funding anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers, therefore creating a perfect right-wing analog to Planned Parenthood, which we can then culture war about forever and ever in the context of the federal budget. This is not going to be a good thing. And, you know, I think that our politics are also, there's been a lot of pixels spilled on this, but I do think it's worth saying on the abortion issue in particular, when it becomes acute, people really want to attribute bad faith to their opponents. They even more so than other arguments. You know, the words bloodthirsty to describe people who are pro-choice I am seeing out there. And, you know, and the Handmaid's Tale stuff for the people who are pro-life. And I think that's ridiculous. And I really, you know, of course, there are going to
be
bad faith actors.
Both the pro-choicers and the pro-lifers have converged on the Handmaid's Tale as a metaphor, but in a different way.
Yeah. So
not even written by an American. I hate to see all those royalties going to a Canadian author.
There are going to be bad faith actors.
Hurts the balance of trade.
There are going to be jerks on both sides. But it's, you know, as Nick just cited with all of this polling, like, it's very clear that there are some shared values, but there are also some sort of deep fundamental disagreements, and that people really are approaching this issue in good faith. And the arguments that I'm the most interested in, both from politicians and from just kind of people exploring these moral questions, are the ones that say, that where pro-choicers like myself are saying, okay, listen, let's take for granted that there is some moral weight to the fetus. And, you know, Nick, I think disagrees with this or disagrees with it.
No, I believe that what we had was a political compromise that you know, took into account two sets of rights involved.
Right.
And it's just
so. If you say, okay, listen, you know, there's some moral weight here. We already know that we attribute different levels of kind of moral import to different types of deaths, right? So we have, you know, deaths in self-defense, deaths in war. We have the concept of manslaughter. We have, you know, we have many, many, many ways in which we think and talk about killing and death that are not the kind of black and white that you get from the simplest version of the pro-life argument. And then to me, once you do that part of the conversation, the part that is getting still some attention, but I think not enough, is what happens in the states that are now, you know, outlawing choices that many, 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 many people in that state believe in good faith should be legal and are moral to do. And we already know that the federal government and that state governments are willing to do horrific things to people in the name of the war on drugs, which is a, you know, it should be an even easier question. This is people, for the most part, just hurting themselves. There is not another moral person, there's not another life, there's not another creature with moral value in the equation, or not primarily. And then what we end up with is this kind of cascading willingness to allow the state to do terrible things in the name of enforcing this law that people of good faith disagree on. And so, you know, we're thinking here of Billy Binion has written about some cases where miscarriages are investigated and perhaps even prosecuted Liz Nolan Brown has written some really good stuff about what abortion bans might do in terms of free speech. We have this question that is now going to pit the FDA potentially against anti-abortion states, because the FDA says, no, no, it's legal to distribute these abortifacients in those states. You know, there is just going to be an incredible onslaught against primarily women. The people who suffer the most will be people who don't have the resources to clean up their paper trail and travel to another state and, you know, get their abortion where it is mostly legal. So I think it's so important at the end of this abortion conversation, because I know we need to move on, but I think it's so important at the end of this conversation to just say people disagree, and they disagree in very, very, very good faith. They are coming to this conversation with these disagreements, and they're going to act on those shared on those disagreeing underlying moral intuitions. And that is what's going to cause the strife. That is what, you know, it is going to be people doing what they think is right and winding up in conflict with each other.
I don't think that there is, it's strictly equivalent to say there are bad faith actors on both sides, because let's say you are an extreme, you know, pro-choice abortion rights person, and you say you should be able to abort a fetus up until delivery, or even in the delivery room. You could still, if you're pro-life, you could eradicate abortion by using moral suasion and things like that. If you are saying that abortion is murder, that is an extreme position, and it's going into it's going to be operationalized in certain states, and that creates a nightmare from a specifically libertarian point of view in terms of government overreach. And you know, in places like South Dakota, Kristi Noem has already said she is going to ban the use of abortion pills, you know, RU486 and things like that. And they are going to ban abortion everywhere. So I don't, that's an extreme position in a way of saying, you know what, having abortion rights through the first trimester or to viability or to some point where then it gets fuzzier, that is, you know, that is not the equivalent of saying abortion is murder, because when you say abortion is murder, life begins at conception, you are implying a complete, you know, totalitarian kind of epic, you know, a surge in government activity.
Yeah. So again, I am not saying those positions are equivalent. And I am strongly, strongly pro-choice, and think for all those reasons that you just outlined, that people who are strongly pro-life to the extent of prosecuting both women and doctors and aiders and abettors for participating in abortion, that will be a massive expansion of the state, and it will be a bad thing. What I am saying is that the people who believe that some or all abortions are murders, that are they are equivalent to other murders that we do prosecute, those people are arguing in good faith, just as the people who disagree with them are arguing in good faith.
I would just say that they're not arguing in good faith when they say what is good about this is simply that it returns the decision to the states. Because I think this is, like, if it is murder, it should be banned. Right. I mean, we wouldn't say, oh, well, you know what? Indiana has a different concept.
But that's what I'm saying is we accept all kinds of killings and treat them all kinds of different ways, including differently in different states. Like, that is our status quo. Maybe you don't think it's the right one, but that is where we are.
All right. Let's continue the good faith culture war discussion in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Are you working too much? Not taking enough time for yourself? Have you ever felt burned out? What did it feel like to you? Life can be overwhelming. Lots of us feel burned out, even sometimes when we don't know it, or we're only being informed of it by our weird work dreams. Symptoms of burnout can include lack of motivation, irritability, fatigue, and more. Burnout isn't always caused by work either. BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life. Life can be stressful even when it feels like everything's going well. Talking about those stresses with a therapist can ease life's hidden burdens. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right, now let's move on to another segment we'll call Suns Out, Guns Out. The Supreme Court didn't just rule on abortion. They also recently issued big rulings on guns and school choice. Let's start with a gun case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. Damon, tell us why this case is a big deal and what it's about.
Well, it's a huge deal to say that the Second Amendment right to armed self-defense that was first recognized in 2008 against the federal government in the Heller case and then recognized 2 years later against the states in the McDonald case extends outside the home. Those previous gun precedents dealt with handguns in the home and laws striking that down. So this is a case that says that right extends outside of the home. New York had what was called a May issue handgun licensing permitting regime, which is that you want to get a license to carry a concealed handgun. You have to satisfy a bunch of objective criteria that the state lays out, but then you also have to go to a local licensing official. In New York, it was mostly judges. In other states, it's sometimes like the local chief of police or sheriff. And then you also have to satisfy that person. And New York's requirement of special need, it was called, it was not a special need to say that you had a generalized self-defense interest, that wasn't sufficient to clear the hurdle. And the Supreme Court in this case this week or last week said, no, that it violates the Second Amendment. That places too much discretion in the hands of these local licensing officials, that the 43 other states that have what's called a shall issue regime, which is that the state sets out a bunch of objective criteria. And so long as you meet that, then you would qualify. That's the way to do this sort of licensing. It's
so that objective criteria can be pretty substantial, right? It's not just sort of you walk up and you sort of sign a form and you have a gun license. I mean, there can be a considerable requirements associated with that. But it has to be something that like anybody, you just have to be able to show you checked the boxes rather than, oh, the chief of police or somebody else sort of makes a kind of a decision about you and your circumstances, right?
The discretion in the hands of the local licensing officials was kind of the key issue in the case. That that's really what the court decided. That leaves for the future all sorts of is a mental health check. Is that okay? There's a lot of the objective criteria that's going to be challenged in future cases. The Justice Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence in this case where he said, listen, that stuff's all fine. That's all constitutional. There can a lot of gun regulations pass muster. This particular one didn't for this particular reasons. Chief Justice Roberts joined him in that. So at least two of them are signaling strongly to lower court judges and to lawyers bringing these cases that, you know, some of these gun control measures are presumptively constitutional. So, you know, take that into account. There'll be some debate about that going forward. So it's a little narrower in some senses than I think some of the commentary is making out to be. But then at the same time, it's huge because of this recognition of the Second Amendment right, the individual right extending outside of the home. It's the first time the court has recognized that.
We could probably do a full hour just on that case, but I do want to highlight another recent ruling. Nick, this one goes to you. This is I want to ask you about Carson v. Macon, which was about whether Maine's tuition assistance program violates the Constitution by excluding private schools that offer sectarian or religious education. The liberal wing of the court, which lost here, argued that to fund religious schools using school choice dollars violates the separation of church and state. The majority opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts said, no, actually, that sort of restriction amounts to a form of discrimination against religion. Is this the sort of thing that school choice advocates want to see?
Yeah. And it's also just, you know, one thing that goes kind of unspoken about the contemporary Supreme Court really is the Catholicism of it. And this case in school choice, you know, so that it has obvious, you know, kind of implications or echoes with abortion, but also with school choice, because Blaine, James J. Blaine, the continental liar from the state of Maine, was super anti-Catholic and helped usher in laws that ultimately precluded tax dollars going to fund Catholic schools, because being anti-Catholic was, you know, kind of a starting point for many 19th century politicians extending into the 20th. School choice advocates have been pushing for this, you know, in terms of backpack funding and things like that. If tax dollars are going to an individual or to parents or individual students, it doesn't matter what schools they're going to, because it means that the state is not fundamentally trying to advance a particular religion over others. And we know this, we take this for granted in things like Pell Grants, where tax dollars, federal tax dollars, and certain state, depending on the state, dollars go to college students who go to religious schools or non-religious schools, state, you know, private schools, public schools, it doesn't matter. And this is merely applying that to K through 12 education. There have been a couple of cases about this, including Espinoza from a few years back, that kind of cleared the ground for this. This may be one of the most important decisions in terms of clearing the way for more school choice. And what is great about that, I think, you know, going back to something Catherine was talking about, you know, when, you know, it gives individuals more ability to do things. It recognizes individual rights rather than states' rights or federal rights or government rights. So it's all good on that score.
Catherine, the Supreme Court also released big opinions on criminal justice, including Miranda rights, execution. So we had guns, abortion, school choice, prisons and policing, and just this morning, about a half an hour before we started taping, there was also a ruling on school prayer. So I think the only thing missing here is a case about drag queen story hour. The Supreme Court has kind of become the battleground for America's culture wars. It's a bit of an overstatement, but it sometimes seems like practically every major social or political controversy ends up decided by 9 unelected graduates of a handful of super fancy, super select law schools. So, you know, there are obviously legal traditions. It's in the Constitution. There's a pretense of neutral decision making that Roberts in particular has tried to preserve. But the whole thing, like the robes and the ceremony and all the weird secretiveness, like about what's going on inside the institution, it's kind of feels like a secular priesthood at times. So I guess my point is, you went to Yale. How does this state of affairs, Matt, is gone but not missing?
Yeah.
I'm channeling him. How does this state of affairs sit with you?
Are you just asking me in general to evaluate the vibes of the Supreme Court? Like, is that the question? Because I will, but
I specifically want a Supreme Court vibe check. But no, there's this, I think there is some disgruntlement on both the right and the left with the way that the Supreme Court has become the arbiter of so many hot topic political and social issues, and the ways in which people feel like that it's not representative. And it's also all-consuming, right? And the stakes are all or nothing. Abortion is obviously the most significant example of that.
Absolutely, this June has been an overwhelming demonstration project in actually the Supreme Court is in charge of everything. And I think that I think that people are both right to worry about that, but also that it is not like that fact as described, that thing that we are sort of living right now. It's not necessarily evidence that something has gone wrong or that the system is not functioning as designed. So, you know, it's very common to say, I have even said on this podcast, like, we maybe wouldn't be in this position if the other branches of government did their damn jobs, right? That the Supreme Court would not be in the position of deciding this stuff, or at least it wouldn't be in the position of deciding this stuff in so much of a vacuum. There wouldn't be so much latitude for its decisions. It's a different thing for the court to say, okay, here is a clearly written law that has gone through the process as designed, as intended, and now we just have to say, like, did they get it right? Did they get it wrong? You know, instead we have these kind of recursive, the Supreme Court ruling on things the Supreme Court ruled on that the Supreme Court ruled on. But I think there is still this very important function that, like, we don't, representative is not the be all and end all. What matters is what rights do people have and are they protected? And I don't love rights language, but that is the language we have to speak, and especially the language we have to speak in this context. And the court at its best says sometimes essentially, hey, this is what the people wanted. The people are wrong. And that's why people hate the court. That's why the feelings run so high around the court, because that's a really tough thing to stomach in a nation that thinks of itself as being a representative democracy. And we are. But yeah, everything is the court. And the vibe right now is unfortunately not good, because despite all of the fancy language, despite all of the layers, despite all of the robes, despite the ban on cameras, people are still going to evaluate these decisions based on whether they like the outcomes. That has to be part of the conversation. It would be stupid otherwise. And as long as we are a divided country, for instance, on abortion, a lot of people aren't going to like the outcome, and they can respect the process, and it's better when they do. But because our confirmation process has also been very fraught and increasingly visibly fraught in recent years, though that's hardly new, people have a declining respect for the process that the court executes, I think. Certainly the suburban white lady demographic is, or I guess in my case, the urban white lady-ish demographic is, you know, is increasingly inclined to use the word illegitimate with respect to the Supreme Court. And that is not great. That's not a great situation. So
you're redefining AOC, who specifically said the court was not legitimate after the recent decision in Dobbs.
She's an urban white lady?
I don't think so. Are you erasing her? I'm erasing her.
No, she is not. But many of my friends are, and they also sound like AOC.
It is disturbing, if I may. You know, the Supreme Court for a long time, people were saying, as you know, Congress, both houses of Congress and the presidency were losing all legitimacy and trust and confidence. You know, at least there was the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court now is in a similar situation. And this, you know, and for good reason. I mean, I think people recognize what Catherine was saying, is that all of this stuff, there's all of this language, but everything is results oriented. You know, people
this
like
this is true on the gun stuff too,
yeah,
right?
Like, absolutely,
America is just as divided on the gun stuff as it is on the abortion stuff on some specific questions. Not this concealed carry thing, but other things.
Well, if I may ask Damon, you know, what does this do to people like we think? You know, Scalia was not interested in results. He was like a legal genius who was working through, you know, with a clean sheet of paper each time. That's such horseshit, right? Like, how is there a way to get beyond, you know, just recognizing that the court is always interested in results and they're just going to do the math to get there?
Well, that's, you know, it's a big question there. I, you know, liberals have been saying that conservative originalists are actually just, they're very selective about it and kind of results oriented, using it when they want to and not when they don't. And, you know, I mean, I've always agreed with that charge. I've had many debates with legal conservatives over the years where I was sort of surprised they're calling themselves originalist after I heard what they had to say. So I don't know what you do about that. I think that's my answer. I don't know.
Okay, since we're talking about the people, let's go to this week's listener question. This one comes from Sam. Dear Roundtable, more than most political ideologies, many of the prominent libertarian thinkers were women. Ayn Rand, Rose Wilder Lane, etc. I think it's safe to say the movement wouldn't exist without them. Too soon. But libertarianism today, fairly or not, is stereotyped as being almost all men, often men who are, shall we say, not the most socially adept. I don't know who you're talking about, but I feel seen. Why has the stereotype developed, and how do we, in practice, change both the impression and the actual amount of women in the movement? And then there was a bonus question for Catherine, in which she's supposed to talk about which roundtabler is like which Buffy the Vampire character slayer. And I think I just said Buffy the Vampire character slayer.
All the words were jumbled, but we got your vibes. So, we got it.
The questioner wants to know which roundtable panelist is like which character from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I just want to let people know I am not going to let Catherine answer that question.
What?
Because
why?
I'm not. No.
I prepared an answer.
Fine.
You will
just go
be
ahead.
Letting me answer
I,
it.
No, but the reason I don't want to is because this is how I distract Catherine when I feel like her brain either needs a break or I just want to like get to pull her brain away from something like
I prepared an answer. It's been a stressful week.
This is the sleight of hand that I use, right? Like how magicians are like, oh, never move your hand in a straight line when you want people to like not follow what you're doing. Like when I want Catherine to not be thinking too hard about something, I ask her to diagram reason staffers using like Joss Whedon shows, and it's like an hour later I will have a complete list.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna give you the short answer. Here it is. Nick thinks he's Spike, but he's actually Faith. Matt kind of thinks he's Giles, but he is in fact tragically Angel. Over time, Peter has gone from being a Xander to being a Giles. I am Willow, and the twist is that Damon is actually Spike.
Okay,
thank
Nick.
You.
Nick, so let's go to you very quickly.
Yeah, what was
the actual question here was about the stereotype that libertarianism is just a bunch of socially awkward
How
jokes.
Come Nick gets that question?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because we got to divide these things up a little bit.
I don't know. I was interested in what Catherine had to say about that. I think sociologically, the libertarian movement, you know, it was inspired by the works of women, but it was mostly, you know, put into practice by men who oftentimes were economists and engineers.
And they tended not to be that thick and rich in sociology and kind of creating movements that are about that kind of stuff. One thing that is fascinating, if you go back and look at the early 70s issues of Reason, there's a lot of people who are trained in psychology, and they were actually trying to bust through that. And they were talking about things like, what's the psychology of liberty? What kinds of individuals do better in free societies that are equipped to make the kinds of choices and all of that kind of stuff? I think I have seen, since joining Reason in 93, a massive increase in the number of women, as well as, I would say, in like the emotional intelligence of men and women in the movement. And I'm happy about that. I think to the extent that we talk about actual things going on as opposed to kind of abstract ideas, we'll have a richer and kind of more lived experience about what a libertarian world looks like, which is what we need ultimately to seal the deal. You use the philosophy to kind of sell the idea, but then you have to be pointing out this works really well because this is liberty in action. This does not work well because it's contravening what people really want to be doing with their lives.
Damon, do you want to weigh in here on either Buffy the Vampire Slayer or the gender balance or lack thereof of the libertarian movement real quick?
Well, I'm really very flattered that I have a soul, so I want to thank Catherine for that.
Great. Okay, so speaking of what gets into our souls, we will end here with our Whatcha Consuming. I am going to take moderator's privilege and go first. I recently read The Elementary Particles, the late 1990s novel by French literary reactionary Michel Houellebecq, who always reminds me of that No Doubt song, Ain't No Houellebecq Girl, I think it is. It's a bleak satire about the desperate...
Matt's gone now.
It's a bleak satire about the emptiness of modernity and how we all feel desperate all the time. Story set in the 1990s, so the specific targets are somewhat different than they would be today. There isn't any social media, for example. But there's a whole lot of ennui and melancholy attached to magazines and sexual freedom and family structures in disarray. It's basically about how modern liberal societies are predicated on atomization. And that atomization gives us things, but not the things we really want, right? It ultimately doesn't make us happy because people thrive on purpose and order. So there's obviously a lot that's still relevant to today's discourse, especially on the right, which in certain corners still spends a lot of time griping about the lack of meeting in modernity and modern life. This is obviously not my view of the world, but the novel is written quite skillfully. It's really mordantly funny at times, just as a satire, and it sort of commits to the bit rather than lecturing in a way that I found kind of appealing. And I don't find its worldview entirely unrecognizable either. I guess where I diverge from it is that I think that if life seems empty or sort of purposeless because of individualization or atomization in society, then that's not a problem with society. It's an opportunity, because then it's our job as individuals to fill life with meaning that we make for ourselves in collaboration with others who are also working towards that same goal. And I'd rather be the one making that meaning for myself than having it foisted upon me as some sort of collective society-wide project. So it's actually a pretty well-written novel, and I think it predicted a lot of our political and social debates that we're still having today. Nick, do you want to tell us what you've been consuming?
Yeah, it actually follows from some of what you're saying. And I'll point out J.D. Vance is kind of like a Houellebecq figure. And, you know, ultimately, you can see from the quote that you read from earlier, he's not upset about people, that people have to find meaning. He doesn't like the idea that, his group or the people he represents have lost control of dictating choices to people, I think. I read a fantastic collection called Droll Tales by Iris Smiles. She's a novelist and short story writer. And I'll just, in her introduction, she says, "All life is sorrowful, said the Buddha. This idea has found expression among countless philosophers, artists, religions, and myths through the ages. Droll Tales agrees. Yes, life is painful and confusing and absurd, but also, this is important, fun, beautiful, and briefly ours." This is a great book. It is mordant, as you were talking about, Peter, really fascinating and good. And if, in fact, there is no meaning to life, Droll Tales by Iris Smiles is a great way to kill several hours before we die.
Damon, have you found the meaning to life in a piece of literature or film?
I certainly have. This month is the 40th anniversary of the release of one of the greatest horror movies ever made, John Carpenter's The Thing, which I revisited. It's in addition to having an incredible score by Carpenter and Ennio Morricone, and practical special effects that really still hold up and are still kind of shocking to this day. It's just a great it's a great piece of work on paranoia and claustrophobia. You know, I know I'm human, but what about you? It was a great watch in the early days of COVID when we were all looking at each other funny about droplets and stuff. And it still kind of works today as we're all looking at each other funny about everything we've been talking about on this podcast. So I feel it has a wonderful bleak vision of the world and I enjoy it.
Carpenter's a big lefty, and that was my understanding is that was intended, at least in part, as a kind of metaphor for the Red Scare and for the hunt for commies, right? And this idea that like it would drive you mad because you would have to find the hidden commie, right? Except in his world, they're actually like the communist is the guy who's been taken over by the alien who actually will kill you. So maybe it doesn't totally hold up.
And it's a remake of a great Cold War version that is obviously about that.
I think Carpenter might be the best director of the 1980s. His run from about 1980 to 1990, which also includes They Live and Escape from New York, is just one of the greatest sort of directorial runs of the last 40 years. Catherine, tell us about your favorite cult horror movie director.
Hell no, do not consume those things. But I will tell you about a podcast that I've been listening to. I'm not done with it yet, so I guess put the asterisk on there. But Heidi World, the Heidi Fleiss story. So this is, we are all living in we're now probably at the end of the 90s revival moment. Speaking of Buffy the Vampire Slayer et al. And this podcast, to me, perfectly hits the space between the slow burn Monica Lewinsky season and the podcast that I raved about some time ago here, Once Upon a Time at Bennington College, which is just a comically exhaustive exploration of the convergent college experiences of Bret Easton Ellis, Donna Tartt, and Jonathan Latham. This is, of course, the story of the Hollywood madam, Heidi Fleiss, who, I think this was all kind of going down in the very early 90s. And so this is one of the first, I guess, scandal stories that I remember. I sort of remember being aware of this story and intrigued and titillated by it, as so many were. I had the excuse of being a 12-year-old, but lots of grown ass men were just as excited about it. So, this is she is a character who I think deserves reconsideration, both because, like all people cast in this kind of madam role, she raises a lot of questions about the idea that sex workers are all victims. And that is something that is increasingly present in our discourse. Is she the victim? Is she the victimizer? Is she both? And also just our general kind of sexual mores. A lot of what this podcast does is kind of poke at the ways that our sexual mores have changed, and our assessment of someone like Heidi Fleiss has changed. It is similar to Once Upon a Time at Bennington College, a very, very voicey and characteristic narrator who, when I'm looking at reviews of this podcast, seems to have rubbed many people the wrong way. Sorry, God, every word is a sex pun. Once you start talking about sex, I really apologize. But I kind of enjoy it and so far have learned a lot, again, in that interesting way of looking back at a news event you experienced, but not completely, and seeing it reevaluated with some distance. I find it particularly interesting and pleasurable way to okay. And you know what? I just give up. There's literally no words I can use that won't sound like sex puns. So fuck it. It's a good podcast.
Oh! Fuck it indeed. Finally, one last announcement. There's a new podcast coming from Reason. It's called The Reason Rundown, and I'm going to be your host. We had thought it would launch last week, but it was briefly delayed. It is going to happen, I promise. The pitch is, every week, I'm going to talk to a single Reason journalist about a single topic, often drawing on a larger, longer piece they have already worked on. The goal with a rundown is not only to show off some of Reason's best work, but also to showcase our many, many excellent journalists. There is already a podcast feed, an advertisement up on Reason.com, so set up your podcast subscriptions now. It's called The Reason Rundown, and it's coming soon. Before we go, just remember, if you like this podcast, if you like Reason and what we do, if you you want Catherine to do a full podcast episode on Buffy the Vampire Slayer one week, you can support our week by going to reason.com/donate. And that is all the time we have today.
You kill gods by not believing in them anymore. It works every time.
Our gods are dead. Ancient Klingon warriors slew them a millennia ago. They were more trouble than they were worth.